Well, hello, all you regenerative agriculture fans out there. Today, I have the distinct honor of a one-on-one with the man himself, Joel Salatin. His most recent book, Homestead Tsunami, is proving yet again that he has his finger right on the pulse of the state of affairs today. He dishes it straight up as always, full of metaphor and amazing, colorful stories. I'm Judith Farrell Horvath, shepherdess and owner at Fairhill Farm, where, besides the livestock, I also help new farmers accelerate new ventures and agricultural projects, no matter how big or small, and achieve success. On this podcast, we'll hear encouragement and entertainment in tales of struggle and success from regenerative farmsteaders, ranchers, and adjacent entrepreneurs. Because I believe in a network of interconnected, small, regenerative farms being the key to a resilient food supply. Along with living soils and clean, nutrient-dense food, it's up to us here today to ensure an earth that future generations deserve to inherit. This podcast is brought to you in part by FOOP, Organic Biosciences. All listeners can enjoy 10% off any FOOP product by entering code REGEN, that's R-E-G-E-N, at checkout. Visit thefoop.com, www.thefoop.com, and don't forget code REGEN. And now, enjoy the interview. Welcome, Joel. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Judith.
I really appreciate you coming on, and you need no introduction. Typically, I ask people to introduce themselves, but I'm just going to go ahead and let that one go because you are the most famous lunatic farmer on the planet, I think, at this point. So let's just get to it. One of the things that I talk to people about is the importance of food freedom and in it, the importance of a resilient, safe food supply chain. So I was wondering if you'd be willing to talk a little bit about a resilient food supply chain. Let's start there.
Sure. We can start there. That's fine. And of course, our whole culture got shook up in the early summer of 2020 when store shelves were bare, and there was this major hiccup in the food system. So when you think about food, I call it the three S's: safe, stable, and secure. Those are kind of the three S's of food. And and so, of course, in the early 2020, all that broke down. Everything broke down. And why did it break down? Well, it broke down because our food system is fundamentally centralized at a scale that makes it difficult to adjust to disruptions. And I don't know about you, but let me broaden the camera a little bit. The way I see our country right now is, have you ever had a wasp nest like on the back porch, you know, like one of the timbers of the back porch? Mm-hmm. And, it's about the size of your hand, and you go in and out of the back door and you see them up there and they're all just kind of, like they're all in comatose. They just kind of, what do they do all the time? They just sit there. Occasionally you see one go off and one come back, but basically they're just hanging out. And and one day you decide to clean up the back porch and you're out there sweeping and cleaning up and you accidentally hit that beam with the broom handle. And suddenly all those wasps they don't come after you, but they're all up, and they're all up, their wings are ready, they're standing up. And that's the way I feel like our country is right now, that we're like that disturbed wasp nest. People have been jolted out of their coma, and they don't know what shook them. They don't know where it is. But there's a new sense of concern, the phrase I hear all the time, Judith, is how do I disentangle? How do I disentangle from the system? I don't want to be dependent on the system. And so here's the deal. What happened in 2020 was a black swan, and then 2 years later, the Putin invasion of Ukraine, sent fertilizer up 400%. That was another black swan. And what happens is when you're in rocky waters, rocky shoals of disruption, you don't want to be in an aircraft carrier. You want to be in a speedboat, you know, where you can navigate the rocks and the shoals. And the problem was that in that centralized, that huge mega centralized system, long supply chains, centralization of warehousing, processing, and even production, that was an aircraft carrier in a rocky, disturbing situation. And that's why it broke down. Here's the question. The question is, if in the spring of 2020, if our country, instead of being supplied by about 300 mega abattoirs, canneries, you know, processing facilities, you know, those are funnels, you know, where all this stuff goes in, Tyson, all this, you know, it all goes in, comes out of this funnel. What if our country, instead of being supplied by about 300, you know, 5,000 employee mega processing facilities, had been supplied by 300,000, 50 employee, community neighbor embedded processing facilities? Would we have had as big a hiccup, as big a shakeup? And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say, I think we'd have been better with about 300,000 than 300. And so here's the truth. The truth is that for decades, Americans have been told a lie. The lie is you just go on to your football games, drink your beer at your, you know, at your TV, get your TV dinner and your Lunchables and your Hot Pockets and your Coca-Cola. You know, we'll take care of you and you don't have to do anything. Go on your Caribbean cruise, go on your Paris excursion, and we will take care of you. As if we will give you the freedom. We will free you up from chores, from gardening, from canning, from domestic culinary duties, you know, all those mundane things of life. You don't want to be shackled to them. You want to be free to go, you know, to the theater and the ball game and all this. And you can get TV dinners and Lunchables and Hot Pockets, and we'll take care of you. What we learned from 2020 was the great aha moment. Oh, the people who were actually free were the ones who gardened, freeze-dried, canned, were in their kitchens. So true freedom, Judith, comes from participation. You cannot have freedom and not participate in the foundational mundane aspects of life. It is a lie to be told that you can abdicate any kind of participation in these foundational mundane things of life and have freedom. No, actually, that is a shackle to a dependency on centralized corporate production, processing, and even agendas that actually tie you down rather than giving you the liberty they promise.
I couldn't agree more. It's you know, when that convenience is packaged as, like you said, freeing you from mundane tasks, but there's honor in work, and there is something very viscerally important about being connected to what you're eating and what you're doing with your time and your food and what you're putting into your family. You have control over it, like you said. You have, you know, personal agency for making those decisions that are appropriate for your family and for the way you live and your personal beliefs and culturally appropriate. And it's when people give that away, it's they're fooled into it. They're not, you know, they're not gaining anything, because kids don't know where their food comes from these
Right,
days.
right. You know, we live in a time where it's fashionable to say, defund, we got the defund the police thing. Well, you know what? If there's something we need to defund, it's defund Tyson and defund Monsanto. We need to defund the supermarket. We need to defund. I mean, there are things we need to defund on a positive scale that will move us to a place of thriving. The average city only has 3 days of food in it. The average household has arguably, just a couple of days. And you may be familiar with the financial guru Dave Ramsey, the debt-free guy. He talks about having a 6 month emergency fund. Everybody should have a 6 month cash emergency fund. Well, I'm suggesting we need a 6 month food fund, a food larder. One of the most successful marketing things we did years ago on our farm. It's been a good while, but I really felt compelled to encourage our patrons to get serious about restocking the larder. In fact, when you say larder to people, they look at you like you've got larder. What's that? Lard bucket? No, larder. Larder is like a glorified pantry. That's where, if I went to your city, whatever, 100 years ago and said, "Where's the food?" You would have taken me to your larder, and there would have been canned goods, dried goods, smoked meat hanging. The larder was where you kept your food. But today, not only do we not use the word, but we don't, we don't have that kind of sanctuary, if you will, in our house. And so I absolutely understand. People are intimidated with all this, with new ideas. I mean, I've had people come to me and say, "How do you make a hamburger?" They're intimidated making a hamburger. They don't even know how to do that. And so, I said, "You know what? I get it. I get it. I say, you ought to stock some food, and you've never done it. You've never thought about that. Maybe you don't even have a freezer. Well, let me, I'm going to be your coach. I'm going to coach you into this. Okay, I'll hold your hand, coach you into this." And so we did a larder coaching marketing campaign where if you bought a like if you bought 10 chickens instead of one, you got a big, great big price break. It was to incentivize and to stimulate volume purchases. Get 10 chickens, get 20 chickens, get a quarter of beef. Not just, a T-bone steak, and equip a food stash. And it was the most successful marketing campaign we've ever done. In fact, we still do it. We give these big deep discounts for volume purchasing because we want people to purchase, quarterly we don't want people to have to go, we don't want to have people to be out of food. Twice a week. That's crazy. That's crazy. Now there are cultures that do that are okay with that, but they have very vibrant local food streams. And it's okay to not have a larder if you know where your eggs are coming from and your carrots and your, you can get by with a little less of that inventory if you really have a direct chain to your supplier locally. But man, if you don't, and in our country, that's very, very unusual. You need to actually stash some of this yourself, whether you grow it yourself, buy it in volume, whatever, and bulk buying is one of the fastest ways to save a lot of money. A lot of people say, "Well, I can't afford good food. I can't, well, processed food is extremely expensive." That's one thing. I mean, right now, today, boneless, skinless breast at Walmart, Tyson chicken, is more per pound than our whole chickens. Now, I get it. It's boneless, skinless breast. You don't get any bones with it. But my goodness, the bones are nutritious too. You need to be making, broth and all sorts of great things out of the bones. And so, the way that you move your price needle is by buying in volume and then keeping it. Then you don't have to run to the grocery store. You don't have to, you actually have it on hand, and you have the emotional, the lack of stress emotionally that, hey, if wheels fall off, we can eat for 3 months.
Yeah, so I mean, you just kind of addressed the end consumer's options for securing themselves, but what about in the greater system? You talked about there being a couple funnels. I read that was it 80% of the beef in America comes through like five or six plants?
Yeah,
It's
that's right.
crazy centralized. So I mean, talk a little bit about the decentralization and then local participation that you had mentioned very early on.
Yeah, so what
The
happened
producer, sorry, yeah.
what happened in those great big plants was that when you've got 5,000 people in a dark, moist, close environment, and I don't want to get in a big discussion about COVID and the
Yeah.
virus. All that stuff. I'm just going to say that the immunological stress, the emotional stress, the political stress, the bureaucratic stress, goes through the roof when you have that kind of confined mega, mega processing situation, just like it does with the animals that are in those factory farms and confined to those systems.
Yeah.
And so, for example, I actually, Teresa and I actually co-own a small neighborhood abattoir here. We got about 21 employees, little federal inspected community, abattoir, does beef, pork, and lamb. And during all of that in 2020, when the great big facilities were all shutting down for 2 weeks and all that, listen, all those CEOs in those big plants, they don't sleep at night wondering, oh no. I wonder if somebody in quadrant four is going to sue me for not having enough plexiglass barriers up, having a protocol. I mean, the HR departments were quadrupled during that time to try to keep everybody happy and everybody not. In our little plant, we've got what, 20, 22 people. Everybody's spread out. Nobody's on top of each other. We didn't have a single bobble. We didn't lay anybody off. We didn't shut down. We didn't, I mean, we just carried right on. And that's the kind of speedboat nimbleness I'm talking about
Yeah.
that is less vulnerable. At the end of the day, these huge, supposedly economically efficient systems are at their core extremely fragile. Because they're skating on the edge of functionality. They're skating on the edge of functionality. And so if you go to what I call an appropriate scale, then you build in a tremendous amount of forgiveness within the system, so that when there are shocks, when there are flexes, you can. It was a lot easier for us during that time to assemble our 20 people and talk to them about whatever we wanted to talk to them about than it is 5,000 people at a great big, JBS or Tyson plant. Much easier to get everybody on the same page. Find out who's scared, find out who's not. All those kinds of those are all issues. And just communication's a lot better with a smaller group than a huge group. And so in these situations, the smaller is the better. If we take the next black swan, Putin's invasion of Ukraine, fertilizer jumped 400%, and all the farmers are, on the media whining and complaining, oh, what are we going to do? Fertilizer's gone up, blah, blah, blah. We just laugh because we don't buy any of it. So
Yeah.
if you're looking for a stable, secure, safe food system, you want to patronize a farmer who is less vulnerable to Moroccan rock soft soft rock phosphate, to Russian anhydrous ammonia, and to these mega processors. Even our so we buy grain here because we have chickens and pigs, they're omnivores. You need grain for them as opposed to herbivores, which we don't buy any grain for, but the omnivores we do. So our supply, we use GMO free, genetically modified organism free. We don't use any GMOs, and we get it all from local farmers here. We know who they are, where they are, they're close by. And so in a mega whatever shock, the chances of being unable to get grain from a neighbor is way less than the chances of being able to get grain out of Ukraine through Istanbul. And those are the kinds of things when we talk about localization and forgiveness and ability to be resilient in the potential shocks of a system. Those are the kind of things that we're that actually stand the test of time. That they have always stood the test of time, and they will stand the test of time in the future.
Yeah, it's going to be a tall order, because I think over the past couple decades we have really consistently shut down the small abattoirs, and we have a lot of monocrop, huge monocrop, when it comes to vegetables and produce that come from all across the country. Small producers have been squeezed out. Small processors have been squeezed out. It's not going to be a fast process, I think, to get things started back up, because there's a lot of regulatory burdens, there's a lot of hurdles, there's a lot of money to be invested with, I mean, let's face it, not like a huge rate of return. So we're going to need people to invest with their hearts and not their pocketbooks. That's going to be a tall order.
Well, it is, but at the same and at the same time, when people ask me, well, what's the hurdle? What's the weak link? What's holding us back from? Because look, when you and I talk like this, intuitively everybody knows that we're speaking truth. Like when I asked, should the country be supplied with 300 mega processing facilities or 300,000 neighborhood processing facilities, as the funnel. That's a rhetorical question. Nobody's going to say, I mean, unless you work for Monsanto or something, but or Tyson, but almost nobody, just regular people, the regular soccer mom on the street is not going to say, oh, I'd much rather have a very centralized, 300 mega processing facility supplier than a democratized, diversified, 300,000. Okay, so the what is the weak link? What is the hurdle to get there? Certainly, one is regulations. I think we're gonna talk about that here shortly, but another one is simply people need to own the future. It changing your buying habit from Walmart to farmers market to some local farmers doesn't take an act of Congress. You don't have to get a license to make that change. You don't have to ask for, somebody to give you the freedom to do that. You can do that today. And people always, blaming the farmers. The farmers do this, farmers do that. Yeah, farmers do. But farmers are supplying the market. Farmers have always supplied the market. And when the market changes, farmers change with it. And so at the so the truth is that while it's fun to, riff on the farmers for a while and why do they use this and do that and do that? Well, it's because you're buying it, friend. You're buying it. Stop buying it and start changing your and start funding the dog you like and defund the dog you don't like. That's really a simple procedure. And so we need to look at the mirror and realize we as food buyers have created the agricultural system that we have. We've created it. And we need to uncreate it. Same situation by empowering and funding and encouraging and inspiring an alternative approach, which simply means moving our patronage from where it is to where we'd like it to be.
Yeah, that's sort of a hard look in the mirror, as societally speaking. It
Yes.
that can be some tough medicine to kind of, well, I don't see enough farmers around, but farmers can't stay in business and ranchers can't stay in business if they don't have their customers first. And the first thing that everyone says is, make sure you're meeting your market before you go and grow it and produce it, because it takes a long time to produce a vegetable or even longer to grow a beef. My goodness. So let's talk about the let's talk about choices in the grocery store. Like if you want to, what's the type of food that you want to eat? Have that conversation. It's a different way of purchasing for
Yeah,
people. It's
so
starting with raw ingredients, first of all. It's not processed, and but then getting the stuff you want.
yeah. So I'm a big believer. I tend to not tell people how to shop at the grocery store. I tend to tell people don't shop at the grocery store. Let
Yeah, I do the same thing. I tell people, don't go there. You surrender your food freedom when you go to the grocery store. That's where you pay to give it away.
that's
Yeah.
right. So how do you so I mean that is just that's intimidating, all right, to the average person. So
It is.
how do you punch through that? All right. Well, first of all, let's take them in categories. All right. So let's take meat, poultry, and eggs. Those are now extremely available from pasture-based farms near everywhere. There, I mean, obviously we're one, but there are thousands of us now who offer grass-finished beef, pastured pork, pastured chicken, pastured eggs, pastured dairy. I'm talking about non-confinement. Now, there are thousands of us, but we're not at Walmart. We're not at Costco. I had the sorry, years ago, the nine direct reports for Sam's Club, the nine vice presidents came by here on a 2-day, like a nature sabbatical thing, and I had them for a half a day, and we're sitting there, and took them on a farm tour, and they're sitting there. So this is vice presidents for Sam's Club, which is kind of they're quasi Walmart, Costco. It's Sam's Club. It's all about Sam Walton, all right, and the Empire. And so they're sitting here, and we're having sack lunches with these VPs, and one of them says, "Well, how do we get your stuff at Walmart?" And we got a Walmart, whatever, 15 minutes away from us in town. And I said, "Well, the first thing you have to do is allow a truck smaller than a tractor trailer to back up to your dock." End of discussion. End of discussion.
Oh
They
my
could not,
goodness.
that they, I mean, we got a Walmart 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes away. They could not imagine a system in which a truck smaller than a tractor trailer could back up to their dock. I mean, it was off the radar. So that was the
That
end
was
of
the disqualifier? That was it?
the discussion. Yeah, we can't even continue the discussion because you can't even conceive of it. And so
So short-sighted. Oh my gosh.
so that's the kind of stuff that's our reality. That's our reality. And so that's why going down to your grocery store, your Kroger, Aldi's, Trader Joe's, Giant, whatever, and saying, "Well, I want this." It's not going to work. You have to just disentangle, opt out of the system, build a parallel universe, go outside the orthodoxy. Now, so beef, pork, chicken, dairy, very available. And if I may make a shameless plug, we ship nationwide. So if you can't find anything quickly, we ship every week nationwide. Get it from us, and until you find your and nothing, Judith, nothing makes us happier here at Polyface than getting an email from somebody. "Hey, I didn't know where to go. I started with you guys 3 months ago. I've been taking my time here to find a local supplier. Oh, I finally found one, so I'm not going to get from you anymore, but I've got my local supplier." Man, let me tell you, that we love that. We absolutely love that. Okay, so a little bit of shameless plug there, but I want you to get started. I mean, what we have to do first is to stop the grocery routine. You know, routine is a rut. A rut is like a grave with the ends kicked out. And you know, and you just get in that rut and you just stay in that rut. All right. So come off the edge at one point. All right. So there's that. All right. Vegetables. What about vegetables? All right. Well, you can grow a lot yourself. We can talk about that. But beyond that, you can go to farmers market. Again, you can get a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, share. And you can have these, you know, you can go pick up, they can bring it to you, whatever. There are a lot of vegetable options. Now, the critical thing there is the seasonality. So, you know, if you live in you know, California, San Diego, you can probably get fresh vegetables year round, or, you know, Louisiana or South Georgia or whatever, Florida, yeah, you can get vegetables year round. If you live where it's cold, like where we live in Virginia or north of us, you know, it's going to be hard to get vegetables year round. So what do you have to do? So guess what? This is why canning, freeze drying, dehydrating, it's taken things by storm. So I mean, for us, ever since we've been married, well, I mean, our family, and then Teresa and I got married, and she notched it up to another level. I mean, she cans, I don't know, 800 quarts of stuff a year. So let me tell you how we buy apples. Okay. So we don't grow all our, we have on the farm that are eating apples. So, you know, when they're ripe, we eat them. Okay. But we don't have enough to make applesauce, and we love applesauce. And so there's a nearby orchard. Well, it's, you know, it's an hour away. But we go up there every fall, and we get about 15 bushels of apples. We bring them back. Every bushel gives you 20 quarts. So in 5 bushels of apples, you can can 100 bushels of applesauce. And that gives you 2 quarts a week for the whole year. So that's the way we do applesauce. Okay. We have an orchard that grows peaches. So every year we get 4 or 5 bushels of peaches, bring them home. We can peaches. So when Teresa sends me grocery shopping, she gives me a list. You know, bring me up a quart of tomato juice, peaches, applesauce, and pickled beets. You know, and I go to the basement and I look at the shelves and I bring up, you know, the pickled beets, the applesauce. That's just the way we live. Okay. And I mean, you know, we've got almost a year's worth of food down there. You know, that doesn't need refrigeration, doesn't need, if the power goes off, it's all still okay, and it's just there. So you know, buying bulk, you can go. I mean, listen, if you go to farmers market, or you go to your local produce outfit, roadside stand, and say, you know what, I want a canned green beans. Can I get 2 bushels from you? You'll probably come with your defibrillator, because you'll probably have to pick them up from a heart attack, because nobody asked for 2 bushels of. I mean, my wife's family, they always grew, it was a quarter, I think it was a quarter acre, maybe a half acre. It was huge, a potato patch. And they sold bushels of potatoes in the fall to people that would buy, you know, their potatoes and keep them for the winter. And I don't know how they made thousands of dollars off of that little, you know, half acre potato patch, selling to neighbors and friends and stuff around, you know, bulk potatoes. A lot of them, they put them in a burlap sack, you know, a whole, and you could get about a bushel and a half in a burlap sack, and people take these sacks of potatoes away. So buy in season and use your kitchen. When I say get in your kitchen, people ask me, what's the number one thing people need to do to stay alive and save their business? My kitchen. But this is not great grandma's kitchen. You don't have to go with a wooden bucket to the spring to get water. You don't have to put wood in a you don't have to put wood in a stove to get hot water. You got hot cold on demand. You've got water on demand. I mean, you got time bake in the oven. You've got bread makers. ice cream makers, Instapots, crock pots, pressure cookers. I mean, great grandma would have given her eye teeth for the kind of techno glitzy gadgetry we have in our kitchens. We no society has ever had more sophisticated gadgetry in their kitchens and been more negligent as to using it. And so you know, we have this capacity, and so what we need to do is make is remake the kitchen as the heart of the home rather than the entertainment center as the heart of the home.
I love that.
We have substituted the entertainment center, and that includes video games and everything else. We Listen, right now, I got a good statistic for you. I just read it the other day. The average American male, okay, I know we've been talking about kitchen. A lot of people thinking, you know, we're talking about women. No, listen, the average American male in America between 25 and 35 years old, so between 25 and 35 years old, the average American male spends 20 hours a week playing video games.
Oh, yuck.
Yeah, isn't that the truth?
Oh, that's such a
Think,
waste. It's such a
it's,
waste
of
of
course it's
time.
just like, think what all that could return if it were invested in everything from gardening, culinary skills, goodness, take a course in small engine mechanics, plumbing, electrician, welding, basic carpentry, putting in drywall. I mean a million things that you could learn a skill, a trade. Listen, in my view, the true 401k plan, the true 401k plan is knowing and or having a relationship proximate to people who know how to grow things, fix things, and build things. If you and your friends know how to grow things, fix things, and build things, that's better than all the stocks on Wall Street there are.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I want to be the one guy who knows how to grow, build, and fix when I've got all of my neighbors hungry with things broken.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you have any of those skills and the wheels fall off, you're not going to lack for work or for, barterable,
Very true.
barterable opportunities.
Very true. Very true. Oh my goodness. Yeah. So when people go and they start doing for themselves or they start getting from other sources, they encounter things like, dare I ask, raw milk.
Yeah, I'm all about raw milk. We get raw milk, and
Could you go over real quick the difference? Like, so many people believe that it's dangerous, and I have recently come to be able to understand the difference between raw milk and that you have the milk that is from the cows that are kept in a way that is intended to be raw versus pre-pasteurized milk, like from light. Could you talk about the difference in safety between those?
Nutritionally, raw milk is far, far superior with, enzymes and all sorts of, things that are killed in the pasteurization process. Where this prejudice against raw milk developed, and I'm calling it a prejudice, was between 1870 and about 1920. So you got about a 50-year period of time there where we had the industrialization of the country, and the industrialization and the urbanization. So the cities grew, and all of this concentrated population was happening prior to refrigeration, indoor plumbing, even refrigerated transportation, things like that. So there were two beverages that required refrigeration but couldn't be transported during that 1870 to 1920 period. One was milk and one was beer. Okay. And when you make beer, you of course, you're using grains to ferment, and you have a byproduct. It's called distiller's grains. DGS is the distiller's grains. And so that's firm, and it's kind of a porridge, a swill, okay? And so what happened was they linked up, and of course, this is before microscopes were commonly used. I mean, we're just coming out of the idea of, I wonder if we should sterilize, surgical equipment before, taking off a leg. And so we're still in this point. And what happened was they hooked up the dairies and fed the cows. These were called swill dairies because the cows were eating the distillers' grains from the brewing companies. So basically the beer and the milk were hooked together,
Yeah.
not only economically, but in proximity in the urban sector in the city, so that people could get beer and milk, prior to having refrigerators and, refrigerated distribution trucks and all those kinds of things. And when you feed a cow that kind of feed, it changes the acid in her rumen and makes it conducive to all sorts of diseases, undulant fever, tuberculosis, all sorts of things. So what happened was milk became a vector for all of these diseases through the swill dairies.
Oh, my.
And they were filthy too, Judith. I mean, if you look at pictures, the campaign for raw milk stuff, they've got these pictures of these old, I mean, the cows are in poop up to their, udder, just, it's just filthy. Okay. All right. Well, interestingly, during that time, the Mayo Clinic, everybody knows about the Mayo Clinic.
Oh, yeah.
They began, they went out there in Minnesota and said, we're going to raise milk on grass in a hygienic way. And lo and behold, it had such curative properties, this good raw grass-based milk. It had such great curative properties that the Mayo Clinic began having success with diseases that nobody else could, and that was the start of the Mayo Clinic brand, was through raw milk that was grass-based and sanitary, in contradistinction to the swill dairy milk that was available in the urban sector. Now,
Well,
the difference between the good milk and the bad milk was apparent to everyone by 1920, 1930. The bureaucracy knew about it, but by that time, it was easier. The food police, the U.S. the U.S. duh, the F duh. I call the U.S. duh, the F duh. It was easier to just create a one size fits all blanket rule, all milk has to be pasteurized, than it was to actually say, well, this milk is fine raw. This milk needs to be pasteurized because it's filthy. That was a much more complicated administrative regulatory environment than just a blanket pasteurize at all. And that, Judith, is where that's the background of where we've come to. And the problem is, as you know, once a regulation's in place, it's really hard to get rid of it. And so, including, in all fairness, including the concern, the fear. I mean, health department people were justifiably scared of that swill dairy milk because it was a vector for all sorts of diseases and maladies. It was filthy milk, okay? And so here we are, a century later, and we're still struggling with the halo, the halo effect. Is still reaching us at this point. Now we have microscopes. We've got little lab. We can check for somatic cell count real easy. Any kind of utter infection, mastitis, with little pH strips. In 5 seconds. You can dip it in the milk and boom. So we've got all sorts of cool technology now that can actually that can bring a simple little lab test kit that would have been unheard of in 1910. Now you can have this even with two or three cows in a little raw milk dairy, and it's not expensive. It's very, very cheap, and you can test your milk if you're concerned about it.
It's hard to get raw milk though. I mean, it's difficult for, I have goats, which I know you're not fond of, but because of the size of my land and things like that and the type of land that I have, goats have been the right answer for my family. And so we drink raw goat's milk. And I am reproached all the time by people who say, "Oh, could I buy milk from you?" And I have to say, "No, you're not allowed." But I hate saying no. I hate saying no.
No, absolutely. So that brings us to the whole, regulatory question and the freedom of food choice issue. Judges have ruled, a lot of people are shocked to hear this, but in numerous rulings, in court proceedings, judges have ruled Americans do not have a right to choose their food. They do not have a right. And so that was not that that is not a guaranteed right in the Bill of Rights. And so right now the government has the legal power to determine to determine what can be sold and what can't be. And this is one of the reasons why John Moody and I, several years ago, started the Rogue Food Conference, because we began realizing that the tyranny of the food police in our country has gotten to the point where circumvention is more efficient than compliance. And so, in fact, we're having the seventh conference here at our farm, actually, in May. You
I'm
can
going to
Google.
be there. I bought tickets. I'm going to be there. I can't wait. It's my first one. I'm
Good,
excited.
good, good. Rogue Food Conference. And what we do is we create a stage and a platform to showcase people and methods that have created a way for food transactions to happen that is outside of commerce. Okay, so the way that, see, I can give a, you, look, you can give away your raw milk, your goat's milk. You can give it to your neighbors, and that's perfectly fine.
That's true.
You can't sell it to them. So if it were really a hazardous material, it ought to be illegal to give it to them, because that's the way it is for narcotics and drugs and hazardous, substances. It's not only can I not sell cocaine, I can't even take it if I want it. All right. And so things that are actually considered, ha and I don't want to get in a debate about, about the whole drug thing. Okay. I'm a pretty libertarian, and I think that a government that can keep you from taking cocaine can also keep you from getting raw milk. Okay. I mean, that's the slippery slope.
They treat them the same.
It's, I mean, they're not the same, but legally, do you have choice or do you not have choice? That's the question. And even in a bigger question is, do I own me or does the government own me? Am I an autonomous individual with control over the fuel for my microbiome, if I may be so bold? Do I get to make that decision or does somebody else get to make that decision? The other thing about this is, it's not illegal for your neighbors to buy your milk. It's only illegal for you to sell them your milk.
Wait, say that again. There's something important there.
Yeah, there is very important.
Okay, say that again.
The prohibition is not on acquisition. I can buy your milk and everything's fine. You just can't sell it to me. So it's only a one-way prohibition. The prohibition is on sale, not on purchase.
Okay.
So if this were really as hazardous as the government would have you to believe, it ought to be like cocaine, LSD, fentanyl. The prohibition should be on both buyer and seller, okay? Illegal for both parties. If it's really considered whatever, a societal, terrible thing. But in food, and only in food, I can give it away and I can buy it, but you can't sell it. So it's an extremely hypocritical, legal, whatever, legal circular.
Situation. It's
Yeah,
weird. Yeah.
it's crazy. It's crazy. And so nobody has ever been fined, gone to jail, or slapped for buying milk. Even in states where it's illegal to sell milk, no buyer has ever gotten in trouble for buying milk. The only people that get in trouble are the sellers.
Huh. I bet you
So,
Rogue Food is going to be a lot about a lot of those things, right?
yes,
Yeah. Okay.
it
All right.
will be. So the Rogue Food
All right.
Conference is all about how do we so some of the clever workarounds. All right, so let me just give you a couple of workarounds that we've showcased so far at Rogue Food Conferences. So one is, okay, what we'll do is I'm gonna offer a course for $100 for you to learn how to milk a goat. You can sign up here on the internet, pay with your credit card, and part of the materials of this course that you get as a result of taking this course is you get 5 gallons of goat's milk. Suddenly, you're selling education and you're giving away the curriculum materials, which in this case is goat milk. Suddenly, it's not a sale. See, where the government comes in on you is when it's a sale. But if you can figure out how to make a transaction that is not a sale, not in commerce, the government has no jurisdiction. Okay? Let me give you another one. Let me give you another one. So another legal stipulation for in commerce is that the buyer takes no risk. In other words, when you walk into a grocery store, you say, I'll take, some Jolly Green Giant peas, I'll take some DiGiorno's frozen pizza. The buyer takes no risk. Somebody else grew it, processed it, packaged it, and took all the risk of putting it on a shelf for you. All right. If the buyer assumes risk, then it's not a sale anymore. What's the classic example? The classic example is investment and dividends. Okay. So when you buy stocks and bonds, that's not a They're not selling that to you. You are investing, and your income is unearned income. It's not subject to Social Security like wages, not subject to any of that, salary, all that taxes. So there are food clubs where you invest in the food club. It's a private club, it's not public. You invest in the food club, and part of your investment then comes back as a dividend in food.
Okay.
That's the way community supported agriculture, you're familiar with CSAs. That's why
Yes.
CSAs don't have to collect sales tax. You don't have to report it as earned income as a farmer, because it is an investment. In other words, if you buy a CSA share and whatever, grasshoppers come in and eat all the squash, You can't go back to the farmer and say, "Hey, I thought I was going to get squash. I didn't get squash. I want my money back." Farmer says, "Sorry, you didn't buy squash. You invested in our farm. Our farm failed. Sorry, you get nothing back." That is legally, and that has been shown over and over, that is not a sale because there is shared risk on both the buyer and the seller. Okay. Now, I don't want to get in the weeds too far with you. This kind of
Yeah,
stuff.
gotta save something for May.
But it's fat. Isn't it fascinating that there are very clever minds who are thinking in this way to create what I call carve outs. You've got this big umbrella system that the government has tried to create to whatever to encompass every morsel of food. I mean, one of my biggest aha moments was I was down testifying in Richmond at our state capitol on a cottage food bill, and during a break, the head of our state meat and poultry inspection walked up to me. He was an amiable guy, and he said, "Joel," he said, "we can't let people choose their food. If we did, we couldn't build enough hospitals fast enough to handle all the people that are sick from bad food, because there are bad
What?
farmers out there." And he looked at me as straight. I mean, I'm going to tell you just like he told me. He looked right at me and he said, "Don't you realize I am responsible for every morsel of food that enters the mouth of every citizen in Virginia?" And I said, "Either."
I need to process this.
I know. Can you
Wait a
imagine?
minute. My head is imploding.
That's right. It's exploding. That's right. And I looked at him. I said, "You are either the biggest fool in the state, or how can you sleep at night with that kind of responsibility? If you really believe that, I mean, to put on me the responsibility of the integrity of every morsel of food that every Virginian could put in their mouth is, I mean, it's crazy." But
Why would
he,
you take that job? Oh my
but
God. Shame on him for saying, yeah, I'll take
yeah,
that
yeah, yeah. But he was absolutely sincere. Absolutely,
Oh,
wasn't making a
Nick.
joke. He was sincere. He wanted me to understand the gravitas of his responsibility. And he felt like I was being flippant and cavalier and, "Oh, yeah, whatever. People can just, buy whatever food they want." And he was saying, "No, you don't understand. You don't understand. This is a serious deal." And so ever since then, I'll tell you what it's done, Judith. It has helped me empathize with all these food police. I don't consider them enemies. I feel sad that they have taken upon themselves this incredible responsibility of I'm in charge of everybody's food. I'm in charge of, I mean, it's a burden. It's an unbelievable burden. And so I actually kind of feel sorry for them that they've taken on this burden.
I think that's very gracious of you, Joel. The problem is when someone has delusions of grandeur at that scale, and then they have authority to enforce
Yes.
it, it starts to become very Stasi. And that's then you have the food police in the US, duh, like you said. The results speak for themselves, but I think it's very kind of you to say that you feel bad for them. It's a
It
different
becomes
way of
very
spinning it on them.
yeah, it becomes very despotic. Despotic and tyrannical is that's what we see. But when I take my heart and I'm trying to, as they're another human. I mean, they got their kids in soccer and they got, whatever, they argue with their spouse and whatever too, just like I do. But when I take off that veil or that power thing and look at them as a person, I just, yeah, I feel sorry that they have taken on that kind of burden. But anyway,
Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I just had this idea. Wait a minute. I mean, burst in on you there, but what if there was some way to help them understand that if they really feel this burden to make sure the food is safe, the stuff that's in the food that isn't food at all, that's very unsafe. If we could redirect that, that burden in a constructive way.
Yeah. Well, my answer to it, Judith, is that instead that the problem is when he says to me, we can't build enough hospitals for all the sick people from getting bad food. The problem is I can't disagree, because right now, if let's say our county passed a food sovereignty law that says, you know what, in our county, if you want to, if consenting adults want to voluntarily engage in food choice, it's not the government's prerogative. You want to come to my farm, ask around, look around, smell around, and you want to get a chicken from me or a glass of milk or a pound cake, if you want to get something from me, we're not, the government's not going to stand in the way. The problem is the state won't let that happen, and the federal won't let the state do it. So we've got this federal over the state, over the local, and we can't even try it. I want to say, you know what? Let us just try it here. Put a sunset clause in, try it for 2 years. See if the hospitals fill up. Chances are we'll suddenly have a bunch more profitable farmers. We'll have healthier people. We'll have a vibrant food. And chances are people will come from all over the world to see the food revolution that we've created within our county, and maybe we have fewer diabetics. Maybe the hospital isn't as full as everybody because this reduces the price of good food so much that we can now run Walmart out of business with local food, and people aren't going to Walmart anymore and they're buying. I mean, you can go on and on with this. The point is, let us do an experiment. Why can't you let a jurisdiction, a city or a county, a little local jurisdiction, let us try an experiment and see what's so harmful about that. But they just can't even abide something as tiny as that at an experimental level. Just can't abide it.
So I see how circumvention then becomes the best way to experiment.
Yeah. It really does. And I mean, several states, Florida probably is the leading one, have really created wonderful pet food laws. So you can for $25, you can register any food item as a pet food and sell it not for human consumption. And so now in Florida, the foodies, the urban foodies, they wink, wink at you and say, if you want the good stuff, you get the dog food, And that's what's going on in Florida. And listen, 1 year, Judith, 1 year after the Florida legislature passed that, there were 12 full-time grass-based dairies in operation in Florida. Within 1 year, 12 full-time grass-based dairies sprung up in Georgia. That's what freedom does. Freedom opens up entrepreneurial opportunities that were sitting there, latent before, but now enabled when you offer additional seats at the table.
Well, I feel like I've been sitting on my hands then, because raw milk for pet consumption is legal in the state of Ohio.
Yeah, there you go.
Shame on me. It's right in my face.
Yeah. Huh. Or like the lady in Wisconsin, she's selling cheese. She was actually going across the state line with it, and the government shut her down. She didn't have all that stuff. So she called the Wisconsin Department of Game and Inland Fisheries and asked them, what are the laws regarding fish food, fish bait? I want to sell fish bait. And, oh, really nothing. It just fish have to be able to eat it. That's all. We really don't have any regulations. So now she sells fish bait Colby, fish bait Swiss, fish bait cheddar. And nobody can touch it.
Oh my goodness. That's so hilarious.
This is the kind of stuff that we're that we're shining a light on at the Rogue Food
Okay.
Conference, because the time to comply with everything, the time and money to do that is just, you can't do it small. You got to be great, great big. And that's the problem with all these food regulations, is that they're scaled prejudicial.
Oh,
Look,
yeah.
if I want to make, let's say I want to make charcuterie. All right, charcuterie. I'll make, pepperonis and bolognese and, charcuterie. All right. If the license to do that requires a $5,000 thermometer, for example, a 24/7, thermometer that measures all the 24/7, it gives you a record of everything, all the sophisticated. Well, that's nothing if you're making a tractor trailer load of charcuterie at a time. But if I'm making it in a 5 gallon bucket for folks at church and friends and neighbors, who can afford a $5,000 thermometer if I'm just making a couple 5 gallon buckets?
Right.
And so this is the problem with the food regulations. They do not recognize scale, and then the smaller outfits that do try to comply have to raise their price so high because of the cost of the paperwork and the infrastructure to comply.
Yeah.
It automatically makes their marketing extremely difficult, because they're 30, 40, 100% higher than the big guys who spread this cost over millions and jillions of pieces. That's the truth of the food regulatory climate in this country.
It disincents innovation.
Yes. And it definitely almost prohibits prototypes.
Yeah.
All prototypes have to be birthed as an embryo. Okay, they'll have to be birthed as, an oak tree starts from an acorn. A cow starts from a little baby calf. A human starts with a baby. All right, and the problem is that by the time you economically and logistically comply with the infrastructure and paperwork overhead requirements, the baby is too big to be birthed. And so what we have right now are thousands and thousands of entrepreneurial food enterprises ready to be birthed into their communities, but the baby's too big to be birthed, and so it's a stillbirth, and we don't see it. Doesn't happen.
So that disincents youth too from entering. All these people,
Absolutely.
I mean, youth is, I,
Yeah.
they're not just helpless these days. They seem hopeless. And I wish that for all the small producers, the opportunities that are out there, that we would have a way to incent the youth. And they
Yes.
don't, I mean, my daughter is 24 years old, my son's 22 years old.
Oh.
And my daughter's like, I work my butt off. And she's like, I can barely make ends meet. She's not a farmer. She's a professional dog groomer. But she
Right.
says, she said, it is so stinking hard to make a living wage. And more than anything, she wants to put money away because she wants to buy a farm. She wants to be a farmer.
Wow. Well, bless her. Good for her.
Yeah.
And just, yeah, well, I mean, it's not easy, but boy, it's hard enough as it is. But then when you throw these hurdles of regulatory, these regulatory hurdles in, it notches it, it ramps it up to another level,
Yeah.
which is why the Rogue Food Conference is all about, how do we make an end run around these systems so we can launch legally without having to, without having such huge infrastructure and paperwork.
And then we can encourage innovation and then entice younger people to join. Yeah. So how do you, what are you seeing in the youth today as far as entrepreneurship and, people young just getting launched? Maybe they don't have their kids yet.
So I really encourage people to, if you want to farm, fill up where you are with what you have. So if you have a backyard, turn it into a garden. Put some backyard chickens in it, that sort of thing. Fill it up. And by all means, don't assume that you have to buy land. I think this is, for me, this is the number one thing that keeps a lot of young people from getting in, is this idea that in order to farm, I have to own land. No, you don't have to own land. One of the things that we do here is we've launched lots of farmers, because we do a formal apprenticeship and stewardship program here, and we've got we don't we you know we can't take thousands or even hundreds, but we have launched many farmers now over the years. We've been doing this for almost 30 years. We've launched many farmers that are full-time farming without land. One of them actually one of them actually inherit step one, step two, step three, and eventually basically inherited a farm from a family that didn't want their kids didn't want a farm, but they wanted to keep the farm going. And so this guy inherited a farm, but it was a 10 to 15 year incremental process creating a track record. So what I'm getting at is, your opportunity is not going to fall out of the sky into your lap. The proximity principle is, you start doing with what you want to do and get as close to what you want to do where you are with what you can. If you don't have land, borrow land. If you don't have a backyard, go to a friend that does have one, start a garden in their backyard. Okay. One of my favorite stories is a lady in Edmonton, Canada. She lived in a fourth floor condominium, desperately wanted to farm. She didn't have any money, didn't have any land, but she had one friend with a backyard. So she went to this friend and she said, "Man, I just want to grow something. Can I do a like a 10-foot by 12-foot patch here and just put a garden in?" Friend said, "Sure, go over there and put it in." So she put in this little garden. Well, her neighbor looks over the fence and says, "Wow, that's really beautiful. You think your friend would put a garden in at my place?" "Well, sure, I'll ask her." So, she puts in. I met this lady about 18 months after she started this. She had quit her job, full-time farming, something like 18 backyards. Her whole farm, all her farm infrastructure was hand tools that she made bags on the side of her bicycle. She bicycled from plot to plot to plot, and had a full-time farming career in the city, in backyards. And the name of her business was, you're going to love this, On Borrowed Ground. Isn't that a beautiful thing? And
That is.
so every time I hear people say, "I can't, I can't, I can't," I encounter somebody who's taken the most, difficult situation, and just with sheer imagination and perseverance, created something, just created something. And so, I think that there is a time of unprecedented opportunity right now, because the average farmer is now 60 years old, which means in the next 15 years, half of all American agriculture equity, land, buildings, machinery, half of it is going to change hands. And a lot of it is going to go to children who don't want to farm, but don't want to lose the farm. So they're desperately looking. I mean, I get requests almost daily. "Do you have a young person that can come and handle my land? Do you have a person who can come and handle my land?" I get those requests. I mean, I've even gotten letters from, 80-year-old farmers saying, "Can you find me a young person to inherit my farm to? My kids are just going to sell it for development, and I don't want that. I've spent my life here. I want to stay as a farm. Can you find me a young person to inherit it to?" Listen, the opportunities are there. And so you have to get close, get off your Netflix, get off your video games, and take every spare minute. If you want to do this, take every spare minute and get into your local farming fraternity, and in no time you're going to find land. One of the most one of the biggest opportunities right now is to live in with elderly farm couples who are ambulatory, don't want to go to an institution, but they can't run the farm anymore, and they're looking for a live-in. They will pay you to live with them, maybe cook a meal a day or something. You can then go out and run the land and live there, get paid to live there, and who knows what can happen. So, if you spend a couple of years serving, and they love you, they might cut you in. I mean,
Yeah.
you just don't know. So
Wow.
there are a lot of those kinds of things out there, people begging for, for that kind of a relationship. And so you just have to be very imaginative and creative and savvy, no whining, no complaining, jump in and get on it.
Yeah, those are some solid examples. Yeah, same way that small producers need to learn how to circumvent regulations.
Sure.
Small, young people just getting started out need to learn how to circumvent other barriers.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, it's pretty similar.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, do you have any thing that you would like the audience to hear? Most of them being first generation farmers or aspiring farmers or homesteaders or farmsteaders, the whole spectrum of people. Yeah.
I've got a little parting thought. My
Okay.
parting thought is, when we look at our current American culture right now, if you're a thinking person, you can get really frustrated and angry over lots of things going on, from the economy to, crime in the cities, all the tax burden. I mean, all sorts of things. It's okay. It's okay to be frustrated and angry. In fact, if you want to make a list, make a list and write them down. All right. This is what I'm angry and frustrated about. But then, once you've done this is what I fear, this is what I hate, this is, and you've done all that, okay? Because what all that does is it makes you want to run. It makes you want to run somewhere. And that's okay. If a lion is chasing you, you want to run, okay? But you can't run all day, every day. At some point, so fear makes you run, faith makes you stop and put down roots and embrace something. And so my encouragement is, yeah, make a list, get it out of your system. Okay, go scream whatever you need to do. Okay, but then in take all that energy, invert it into a haven, a bunker, a place, a lighthouse, a place of hope and help. So when everybody else is running in fear and they're hopeless and helpless, they will have a place of hope and help. We, Judith, our tribe, your tribe, my tribe, we are building an ark. We're building an ark. We don't know what's coming. I think most of us who are thinking, we're concerned about things that we think are coming. I mean, not the least of which is that one in 34 children is now autistic. I mean, the healthcare, the burden on healthcare of adolescent suicide, social problems, mental problems, the fentanyl. I mean, it's a big deal. All right? We don't know where this is going. All right. But rather than being paranoid, fearful, and running, let's take all that energy and let's dig down. Let's build roots. Let's build havens. let's build an ark so when the floods come, people have a place to go. That's my parting thought.
That's beautiful, Joel. Thanks for sharing that. Thank you. So for anyone who doesn't know how to find you, want to give your contact information?
Yeah. So I don't do any personal social media stuff. Everything is done through the farm.
Okay.
Polyface, Polyface. You just plug in Polyface on any search engine and you will pop right up. I welcome you to come. We do numerous gatherings here a season. We sell food. You can come for farm tours. I do a lot of speaking all over the world. If you want to put together a conference or something, I'm glad to come and do that. But yeah, that's the way I do a blog. We have a video curriculum. I've written 16 books. I mean, there's a lot there, but all of my contact is through Polyface Farm.
Okay. Thank you very much, Joel. And I've really enjoyed this time. I hope everyone who listens today has enjoyed it as well.
Thank you. It's been a delight and an honor to be with you.
The honor was mine. This podcast is brought to you in part by Foop Organic Biosciences. All listeners can enjoy 10% off any Foop product by entering code REGEN, that's REGEN, at checkout. Visit www.thefoop.com and don't forget code REGEN.